Hi, and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 4th of September. And today I have the pleasure of talking to Andy Kaufman, the people and projects guy. So this week we are again supported by Tamplo. Tamplo is an online tool that turns meetings into actions and has a number of different features. The bit I'm going to talk about today is around the project and task management and the follow-up. Essentially, you have a clear dashboard that shows you an overview of scheduled tasks, alert for late tasks, an overview of team's progress. It saves you jumping into your Outlook and being diverted by that morass of email that we get. You can create your own daily plan in there, or you can, as a project manager, you may be assigning tasks to people. And those people can look at those, have their own daily plans, adding in their own specific items they've got to do, as well as the things allocated to them. For the project management point of view, you get a dedicated dashboard with a list of tasks, knowing what people are working on each project. And there's a load of collaboration capability in there. With the goal of getting no task left undone, more efficiency and motivation, and clear action plans. So if you want to see what this is all about, jump along to tinyurl.com/Nigel Creaser Tamplo. That's all one word, Nigel Creaser Tamplo. Have fun. So what the heck's been going on for the last couple of weeks? Well, I have been on holiday for a week, which has been fantastic. A week in Greece in the sun, first time I've done that in a long, long time. And me and my wife and two daughters staying in a lovely hotel, had a pool close, and we spent a lot of time just playing in the pool, chilling out. And hopefully you guys have had a chance to do something like that over the summer. Came back to the office on Friday, just gone. And actually, it's the first time in a long time when I'm coming back from leave, which I wasn't feeling too down, if you know the feeling. I was kind of ready. I was rejuvenated. I was ready. I saw a post from John Amici on LinkedIn the other day, and he talked about the need for refilling your well, your energy well, and your emotional well, and your creative well, I think is there as well, and we all have different ways to do it, but sometimes we don't practice that self-care, and in doing that I found that is fantastic. Also, one of my previous guests, Tammy Watchhorn, who I mentioned on previous shows, she was launching her new book. Congratulations to Tammy on how well that went. She got there with a bestseller tag, and I think she's had a bit of a whirlwind the last few weeks as it's been released, but it's going really well. And I started reading it on my holiday as well, and found it really interesting. I think I had to share something on when I got to like page 4 or something like that. It was really insightful. So I urge you, pop along to my website, nigelcreaser.com, have a look on the shop page, and you can grab a copy of her book there. I highly recommend it, and I've only a couple of chapters in so far, and I've already found it really useful. So I had really intrigued to see what happens when I get to the end. So that's the main things that have been going on the last couple of weeks. I suppose the other thing to talk about is a podcast. Lots of people available at the moment for interviews, so I've got a lot of those scheduled and a lot of them in the hopper. This one with Andy is the first one where I will be moving to weekly. So next week you will have a part two, so they'll be coming thick and fast over the coming weeks, rather than you having to wait a couple of weeks for the second part. So hopefully that will be useful. What else is going on? The only other thing, I suppose, and I don't know, tell you guys anyway, isn't it? On the podcast, some of you may have seen from many years ago, I did 2017, I started shouting into the internet, as I describe it, and a lot of those initial ones were kind of just being a bit silly and a bit experimental, And I'm not sure if when people have found the podcast or been introduced to them, whether they hit those first few and then found actually what's the point of this. So what I've actually done is paired those back and added in the changed it to be some of the newer the interview type podcasts as being the first ones they see. So maybe that will help as well with listeners and keeping people listening. Final thing was a couple of things that I've seen recently. Jonathan, the Major Projects people, Jonathan Norman, a former guest on the show, set up a thing called Opina, Delivery Experts, where they pose a question, or someone poses a question to a number of people. I'm very lucky to be part of that, in the project management arena, for everyone to give a view on it. And there are some fantastic Wonderwall, as they call it, of all these different videos. They've just relaunched it. It started again a couple of days ago. So have a look on, search for Delivery Experts on LinkedIn, and you'll find some information on that. I'm sure that you will find the comments, the thoughts from the contributors to be both insightful and challenging and informative. So highly recommend that. The other thing, just as a bit of a shout out for PMI, have got their annual awards coming up, and it's now due for the PMI UK, sorry, is ready for and taking nominations. So pop along to pmi.org.uk, I think the address is, and you'll find all the details there about how you can nominate either a project or a an individual in the project management arena who's worthy of recognition. I was lucky to be a judge last year and found the cases that came through across what I was looking at, which was people knew in their careers and around the public sector side, were incredible. So keep an eye out for that. It's really useful. Anyway, I'm going to shut up now, and I'm going to let you get on and listen to Andy, and come back later. Cheers now. Enjoy. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Andy Kaufman to the show. Andy is an international speaker, an author, an executive coach, and president of the Institute of Leadership Excellence and Development, Inc. Andy works with organizations around the world, helping them improve their ability to deliver projects and lead teams. His keynotes, workshops, and executive coaching services have reached tens of thousands of people from hundreds of companies around the years, helping them deliver projects, become more confident leaders, take focused action, and deliver results. He brings a rich background of over 25 years of experience in executive management, technology, team leadership, project management, consulting, and coaching. He is also, and some of you will have known him from this, he's the host of the People and Projects podcast, which provides interviews and insights to help listeners lead people and deliver projects. It focuses on the intersection of people and projects, where the work gets done in a real world. So, Andy, welcome to the show.
Oh man, Nigel, I've been looking forward to this. We've been working to get a date together, and I'm so glad this has worked out.
Yeah, it's always the same though, isn't it? Juggling diaries is the life of a lot of people, isn't it? The added side of it has been on other sides of the pond. It doesn't help either, does it? Because it just adds that complexity.
But I just appreciate your flexibility, and like I said, I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Brilliant. Thank you. I appreciate getting on. So let's get straight into it. People will tell from your accent that you are from the US. Let's start right at the beginning. Where were you born, Andy? Where were you born?
Well, for anybody that knows the states, you know, there's people on the East Coast and the West Coast, but I grew up right in the middle in the Midwest, which is known for cornfields and flat land and tornadoes. And so I grew up in a small town in kind of a cornfield. So, right. So I grew up just in a small town, in which I I'm very happy to have been growing up there, but moved to Chicago after college. And so quite different from the cornfields. And so I'm the guy, even to this day, looking at the skyscrapers, you know, like really enjoy the city.
Yeah. So I'm guessing if I was thinking now, you immediately you say about the Midwest and cornfields, I start thinking of Kevin Costner and Field of Dreams, or thinking about James T. Kirk in the Star Trek thing when he's driving through Iowa in with Beastie Boys playing. I don't know if that is that same sort of that yeah, same that
you get the feel. You totally have got the vibe of what I grew up like. Yeah,
the big massive skies and big long straight roads.
Right. Yeah. And there's many advantages to it. You know, like I think after being in a big city now for a long time, when I go back, I just really appreciate what I was able to experience growing up.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it sometimes as you say, as you grow up, I catch myself sometimes. I live in a rural area, and the town I live in near me is a market town, which I grew up in. And I'm not there as often as I used to be. Mm-hmm. And I'll drive into there from slightly different directions sometimes, and I would be paying different attention. And suddenly there's this one road I remember keeps catching me that I never noticed growing up. But as I drive in there now, every so often I see that we've got a church on the top of the hill, a really nice building just below it, another nice building just there. And I just kind of go, wow, if you're driving into here, never seeing it before, and they've got one of the old, you know, the black and white crooked buildings in the town center, you just go into that town and you think, oh, this is a lovely little town. And to me, it's just you don't see it, do you?
You don't see it. Absolutely.
Yeah, you don't see the beauty of where you are, because that's the way our brains function, isn't it? Is to go, right, that's not changed, right, there's no threat. Which means you don't get that benefit either of how lovely it is.
Every once in a while, I'll run into somebody that says, how could someone live wherever, right? Then I think something my wife and I feel like we've learned more and more as we've gotten older is it's not the where, it's the who. You can live in the most beautiful place on the face of the earth, but if you don't enjoy the people around you, it doesn't matter. Or if you don't have friends or connections, or you can live in a cornfield and be surrounded by people you love, right?
It's the who. Yeah, it is people. And obviously with your podcast and your focus is always about is the people, and we're obviously going to talk about that in a little bit, and people is the, and it a number of times in conversations I've had recently, and the things I see on LinkedIn as well, the conversations going on there, it's kind of which process is going to get the project delivered, and none of the process is going to get the project delivered. Only the people. It's crazy how that kind of thing, that forgetting that squishy things deliver stuff, not non-squishy things. That's so true. You say you live in Chicago now.
Yeah.
So where?
Live in the northwest suburbs of it. So if I was to hop on a train, it'd take me maybe 40 minutes into the city. If I was to drive it, depending on the time of day, it could be 2 hours. But it's close enough that we really get to enjoy the city. And you know, I feel like Chicago's reputation has maybe been tainted in recent years with violence. But you know, just about any big city, there's the upside and the downside. But Chicago, it's a beautiful city. Like Lake Michigan is, if you stand next to it, you think you're next to an ocean. And so it really is a lovely city.
Yeah, it's places I've seen on the TV and kind of places you think, well, yeah, that looks quite interesting to go to. So you mentioned your wife there. What about family? What were you? 100 kids, five kids.
We actually have five kids. Yeah, we have five kids. Have three of which are our bio kids, and then when our three oldest were in their teenage years, we just felt like we're not quite done yet, and so we adopted two additionals. We went from teenagers to diapers, and that was a project we had forgotten what that stakeholder management was like. So that it was a fun like a chance to do it over again. And the three oldest are out of the house, married. Actually, one of them, he's in the film industry, and he teaches some of my project management classes because film is projects.
So he
grew up thinking of it that way. And most importantly, our first grandchild was born last week. So now I'm a grandpa.
Oh wow! Right. So Grandpa Kaufman, we're talking to there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And how's that? Is that so? So you're back with the diapers again?
Yeah. Although they live over in the Middle East. So,
right.
So,
okay.
It's a little further away, but hopefully in August we'll be able to go see him. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. So the gap between my two kids is 5 years, and the shock to our system when we had the second was massive. Teenage, if I did it now with my teenager going to there, my head would explode. So that's off to you.
Well, you know, part of the secret in life is marrying above yourself. And so I did that. my wife's incredible, but actually, no, interestingly, Nigel, the older kids kind of helped take care of the younger kids as well.
Yeah,
there really was something about the developing skills to help them be parents, you know, and so it's all worked out.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing I've always found with ours, with the 5 year gap. Touch wood, I'll touch everything here. We don't tend to get matches. 15 and 10 we've got, and we don't have massive arguments and that. And I know other friends who've got kids who are a bit closer, and I think there's the closer they are, there's a little bit of competition.
Yeah.
Whereas, as you say, you've got that as they're a bit older, they are more protective of the very young sibling. It's like the junior scenario, isn't it? When you've got,
I think so.
It just makes them more protective, and then less argument, and then they'll put up with more. The little one can get away with more as well, I suppose.
Yeah, that's actually a beautiful way of saying it. I think that's a good observation.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, when you grew up in the Midwest, whereabouts in the Midwest was it then?
It was Illinois is one of the states in the middle. So Chicago is part of the state of Illinois, and almost right in the middle of Illinois. So it's a town. It's a little town called Morton, which is outside of a town called Peoria. And so we thought Peoria was the big city, right? But it's
I know that feeling. I know that feeling. Maybe on a different scale, because obviously in the UK where everything's junk. But it's kind of like there's places that when I was a kid I'd look as being that was a big trip to go 30 miles. You know what I mean? That was to the Chester, the city up near Liverpool, you know, and going anywhere, thinking of that there, London was just like astounding sort of thing. And I find it quite shocking. Just it's all perspective, isn't it? That you're saying, you're in Chicago and you've got a 40-minute train drive and a two hour drive. But I'm thinking 2 hour drive for me, that's the other side of the country. it's a 40-minute train drive. I see it as completely different. Is it really interesting on the scale of you guys over in the US and us over here?
But I've got a son who his dream would be to go see a Chelsea game at the home stadium. I mean, that would be his dream. So as much as we have plenty of things in the US, I mean, you live in a beautiful and a historical and, an epic in many ways part of the world.
Yeah. But again, I think it's that same thing of where you come from and where you go, isn't it? You look across to you guys over there and we all romanticize somewhere where we're not, don't we? and actually sometimes with projects, we do the same, I find.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You look at someone else's
company, right? If I worked at that company, if I had that boss, you know, how things would be so much better.
If I had that project, if I had that team, sometimes you'll get, maybe that's a bit extreme on the team thing, but you know what I mean? It's kind of, you do, I think that the saying the grass is always greener kind of thing. It does. We all try not to be like that, but I think it does. It naturally plays out, doesn't it?
There's a former Secretary of Defense of the U.S. who he said something along the line. If this is not a direct one, it's really close. He goes, "You don't go to war with the army you wish you had. You go to war with the army that you have." And you know, that's kind of a version of the grass is greener. Like it might be nice if, but that's helped me in so many situations. I would love to have a couple of different subject matter experts, or I'd love to have different stakeholders, but this is the army I've got. You know?
Yeah.
That's how we lead projects.
Yeah. That's a really good way of putting it. It's kind of, I like that because it gives you that,
Yeah, no problem.
I'm writing this down. And you'll find this. I do this and I don't cut it out now. I've started writing down stuff that I think is of noteworthy so that when I do my little edits, I can pull stuff out. And I'm quite happy to talk about that here. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of these are the bits that kind of make me think, oh, there. And I'm trying to get better at that rather than just trying to work it out. So
brilliant.
For those people out there listening to this, that's why I'm stopped and paused for a moment there.
Yeah.
It's and if you're watching, you'll have seen that I looked like I was looking down at the floor, but that's because I was writing. And I can't do two things at once. That's my stuff when I bang on about productivity, do one thing at once really well. So when you were there in Morton, growing up, what did you want to be? Was it a project manager?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say that because I've yet to meet anybody who at age 8 said, "Mummy, someday I want to be a project manager." Like, we don't usually say that sort of thing. So I knew at a pretty early age, I loved computers. I had an uncle that had the model was called the TRS-80. And I don't know, maybe it's called different things in different countries, but it was one of the
rings
early
a bell.
I seem to call it Radio Shack was the company or something like that. Mm-hmm. But he had it in his closet. He wasn't using it anymore. And he goes, "Would you like this?" You know, Nigel, you would have thought I found like the fountain of youth or something. Like I could not walk away from this thing. And so I kind of fell in love with programming. And then I had a teacher in high school that truthfully, I wouldn't say he was a great teacher for computers, but he didn't get in the way. And I think there's a lesson there sometimes. You don't have to be a great project manager, but don't get in the way. You know? And he didn't get in the way. So if I'd say, "Hey, you know, can I try that?" He'd be like, "Sure." You know, and there was somebody that worked at the school that did some computer stuff. And she's like, I said, "Can I help?" She goes, "Sure." And so I had the blessing of people that just allowed me to do some experimenting.
Yeah.
And just, you know, I had summer jobs then that led to software development. So the early on, like it wasn't be a policeman or a pilot or a fireman or whatever. It's like, I wanted to be a software developer. So that was what I wanted early on.
Yeah. Well, I suppose sort of, I don't want to, unless you want to give away your age, sort of 80s was when that was the pickup of IT was... Yeah. It became something cool, didn't it? You had, you'd watch on the TV, you'd have films, you'd have IT people in the films, wouldn't you? You have things like Flight of the Navigator, you have war games, all the stuff covered in the film Ready Player One. I don't know if you've seen that, a lot of the stuff there. That was when it was really starting to ramp up. And for anyone who's into computers, that those sort of things were kind of making you think, "Well, yeah, can I hack into the NATO computer systems or whatever as a 5-year-old with your VIC-20 or whatever and that's
it felt like the whatever country someone's in, whatever their pioneering days was, that's what it felt like to me. You know, it was like this new thing and all this potential, and it wasn't even that it was cool. I just loved it, Nigel. I mean, I could go without food or drink, you know, for it felt like 12 hours just because I'm playing around. It was probably something completely meaningless, but it still was just this fun challenge of how to learn how to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's that draw to problem solving, I suppose. Yeah. And I know that, I still do it now in learning how to do all this stuff, learning how to publish these books and stuff, learning how to do... some of the sort of artworky type stuff with social media and that. I always find you can sit there sometimes and look at some of me stuck there for ages and you just go, "Hang on, I spent ages doing it." And I think, again, that was something that you had with the computers in those early days is, right, you know you can get it to do something. You didn't have YouTube and you kind of had some instructions from somewhere, and I don't know where kind of got them those days, thinking about unless you've got a book or something, and kind of played around the thing of you get it to say hello, hello on the screen, and then you work out to put the semicolon on the end of the basic, and then it fills the whole screen, and then you get work out how to make it change colors as well. And it's all those little things that the first things you learn, isn't it?
You're speaking my language, Nigel. That was early on because, like you said, we didn't have the YouTube or we didn't have all these other things to be able to help, and so it's just the experimentation. I think to this day, and this is a good side but a bad side of me as well, I love debugging. So like you said, it's a problem solving thing, but the downside of that is the project manager who's the firefighter and always loves just debugging is maybe not forward thinking enough. And so I struggle with that. And also sometimes the perfectionism of like, I gotta get it better, you know, like your social media stuff. I mean, you're doing a really good job, Nigel. I love watching you. I think you do a really good job of helping get the word out, and you invest heavily in our community, which I really appreciate a lot. I don't know if you struggle with this, but it's, when is good good enough, right? Well, like when is it just good enough? And this last weekend, I spent some time with a team member of mine, and he'd come across an acronym, GETMO, G-E-T-M-O, good enough to move on.
Yeah.
GETMO, G-E-T-M-O. And for me, I'm going to hold on to that one because, yeah, all right, this is good enough to move on. You know, this is good enough. GETMO.
Yeah, I like that. And do you know what? I think, kind of go back to the military analogy, and I don't know if this is true, but remember the original Jeeps. I can't remember what Jeep stood for something, and it was just enough something like just enough equipment to perform or something like that. Something like that. And whether that's true or not, or whether it's just, you know, urban myth thing, but that's kind of how it was done. That was why it was called one of those, because they were in bits, weren't they, when they were shipped out to places and they got assembled. So it was just enough things. Yeah. And I think that, and the other one on that analogy in that I heard is Valentino Rossi, motorcycle racer, probably the best, greatest of all time motorcycle racer in MotoGP. His technique was to finish the race in the front as slow as he could, because going any faster puts him at risk. Going any fast could mean he doesn't finish the race, and it's kind of you win it as slow as you can win it, and that's a similar sort of thing, isn't it? And I think the perfectionist in us, and I can be like this sometimes, and actually I struggle with it less than some people, because I am quite happy to make a mistake. I am happy to throw something out there and then go back and go, oops, I've got to fix that. Happy to do it. Did it do its job? Yes. That's the thing. And I think I'm better at doing that than some people, but sometimes not, depending on what mood I'm in really and what I'm doing it on. And I think it does a little pride there. And I think I love I'm sure you've been exposed to it, the disc model. The high C sort of tendency that we have sometimes that can stifle us. And I've talked about it on the show before, where I've got people who I've known have been high C's. I'm more in the high I area. And it's really good to have that combination, because they stop me being an idiot. And I drag them on a little bit. It's kind of really useful balance. I can be a little bit risk taking, a little bit too much, and they're a little bit more risk averse. And it's all these different mixes. So just thinking about you growing up, and thinking about I think we were talking there about how we're kind of learning and how we might, when you were doing the old computers and all that at school. Did you continue on? What did you do after school and high school? And did you go on to college?
You know, I was a reasonably good basketball player, not able to play at the highest levels in college, but good enough to play at, we would call Division II in the States, but it's not like the top ones. But
that's a good level though.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it was a great way to go to school, because, you know, instantly you've got a community and things like that. But right before I went off for school, there was, I wouldn't say he's a formal mentor, but he'd been in business for a while. And I told him that I was interested in computers. And I'll tell you, Nigel, something it was really important he said, he goes, don't just study computers. He goes, too many people come out and they're like super techie, but they don't understand business. And so see if you can find some way to get some business classes in there. And the school that I went to had, at the time, they called it business data processing. But really what it was like a business degree with a computer science degree, kind of married.
Mashed together. Oh, ideal.
It was, as it turns out, a bigger gift than what I realized. Yeah. So I did study that, and then had summer jobs doing the software development. I'm sure I learned far more in the summer jobs than I actually did in school. for sure.
So obviously then you did all that, you're doing your summer jobs, you've assume you passed your exams, etc. What did you move on to then? What did you start doing? I'm guessing you went into that IT industry.
Yeah. It was first jobs, all software development, and at that time, and I suppose to some degree still, they're just, you didn't have to search for a job. There were just opportunities available. So I jumped from company to company, and eventually I was part of a company that had recently been bought out by someone. And then they got bought out by someone, and they fired a bunch of people that were part of the other company. And so I got promoted into management for, I would say, all the wrong reasons. Like, sometimes you see someone who's very good, let's say, answering phones at a call center.
Yeah.
Let's make them a manager of call center people, and they destroy their teams. That was kind of me. Yeah. Like I didn't have any training to be a leader of teams or anything like that. So I would say I was promoted for all the wrong reasons, but it's also why I learned a lot of stuff by making lots of mistakes.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder, and again, you'll correct me on when this was, but the management training around then, I imagine it was limited, wasn't it? It was it was based on a few experts out there, a few books out there, not necessarily a lot of tried and tested scientific experience, and on some, if you want to call it what it is, in industrial age type thinking.
I think so. Yeah.
So it again, even so, and as you say, you see some of this industrial age thinking in call centers now, and in some of the big warehousing organizations.
But
I think that's a thing that I noticed over the years as I've gone through, is the quality of, or what makes sense to me in the management training is so improved over the years about understanding the individual, not trying to corral the individual into a box.
Whether I was trained at Nigel or I just assumed it, but it was all about being the boss. Mm-hmm. You know, like the idea of servant leadership was not something that got talked about. The idea of fostering psychological safety was not something that was being talked about. It was about supervisor subordinate, which really, when you think about it, subordinate, what a terrible term, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so I had to learn the hard way, but it was a technical group. And so it helped because I could at least relate to them to that degree. And we had, some relationships. In fact, I would say my early teams, Nigel, were really strong. So I thought I was pretty amazing.
So they did well despite you.
Right. Yeah. Until I got some teams where they weren't as strong. And then it was like, oh, okay. Maybe I'm not that awesome.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I think you do learn. I remember some of my first roles in project management. I remember running up to a bunch of people. There was a problem with something. It's kind of like, right, where's sysadmin? Why can't they just sort it out? And the person looking at me going, I'm sysadmin and I'm working on it. And I'm like, I was tiny. I was just felt like an idiot. And I learned something that day. And I can remember, there's very few conversations I remember from the company I was in that I was on right there. I remember that one vividly. I can even see the room. I can see the cupboards on the wall. I can see, how I felt and thought, one of the big, your big lessons when you do it wrong, isn't it, sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
There's this guy who's a former head of training at Facebook. And it's probably been a couple of years since I interviewed him, but he had a book on culture. But I'll tell you, Nigel, this idea was helpful. And I think it's related to what you said. If this is not a direct quote, it's really close. He said something along the lines of, every company sucks. Your job is not to make it not suck. It's to make it suck less. And part of the reason why it sucks is you're part of it and you suck. Right? So I almost didn't interview him because that was like the depth of the book, but isn't there some truth to it? Sometimes we think, oh, my company is so messed up or whatever, but hey, I'm part of it. So what am I going to do? And I could blame people. I could blame my team. I could blame the company. I could blame the culture, but what am I doing to make it better?
Yeah.
And make sure I'm not making it worse.
Yeah. It's like when you're sat in a queue of traffic complaining about the traffic.
Yeah.
You're part of it.
You're part of it. Right. Exactly. Yeah. What am I doing? Am I driving in a way that's going to help? Yeah. That's a good point.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that first part of the interview with Andy Kaufman. I will be speaking to him again next week and we'll find out more. So looking forward to speaking to you then. Cheers now. Have a great week. Bye. Wow, you made it this far. I'm guessing that you enjoyed the show if you have. Or maybe you've just left it playing in the background and forgot it was on. But if you did enjoy it and you're inclined to,
I'd be delighted if you could share the show with your colleagues. It's discoverability with podcasts is quite difficult, especially with a niche one like this. But sharing with your colleagues and letting them have a chance to listen to these fantastic guests would be brilliant. If you've got time, a review on whatever platform you listen to it on would be great too, especially if it's a 5-star one. Again, that makes it easier for people to discover the show when they're searching on there, because comments raise it up the old search engine ups and optimization on all the different tools. If you are feeling flush, I have a couple of ways you could contribute. One is Patreon, patreon.com/SundayLunchPM, and you can donate some money to the podcast that way, or you can jump along to my website, nigelcreaser.com, www.nigelcreaser.com, and click on the link to the shop, and in there you've got all my books that I've created in the varying different guises, a number of different ways you can grab a copy of those. And down the bottom I've got the my guests' books, so everyone who's been on here, if they've had a book, I've got a link to their book in there, and Amazon give me a little bit back for when someone buys from them. But more importantly, if you come back next time and listen, I'll be delighted. So I'll leave you alone and let you get on with your day now. Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.